In our study last week in Romans chapter 10, we looked at verse 17, which well-known, easily quoted verse, probably not well understood, but nonetheless, Paul's take on Isaiah 53:1, that the statement, "Lord, who has believed our report," is supposed to be understood with this conclusion, that faith comes from the hearing. The report that doesn't always generate faith is necessary in order for faith to be generated. In other words, faith comes by hearing, but hearing doesn't automatically generate faith. It's just a part of the, it's an integral part of the process. And then the hearing itself occurs because of the word of Christ, which I have taken to be the word that he gave to the ones that he was sending, because Paul's argument is you can't call and be saved if you don't believe. If you don't believe, it's because you need to hear, and if you need to hear, then somebody's got to do the preaching, and if somebody's got to do the preaching, somebody has to send them. And so the assumption is, since the confession is Jesus of Nazareth is Lord, then it's the name of the Lord that you're calling on. He's the sender. Paul is arguing that he's the sent one. And it was because Christ gave him this commission after the road to Damascus experience that the Gentiles were able to receive the hearing that was necessary to produce the faith. And he wants to make sure that we understand that, because it is a conclusion. The "so then" means that he's drawing a conclusion, but the conclusion itself raises an issue that we're going to be looking at this evening. The fact that it's kind of an odd conclusion based on Isaiah's statement, because Isaiah's statement is a statement about how ineffectual the report has become, or has actually resulted, because he gave the report out of the, that's the word, the hearing, it's the noun, out of the hearing was supposed to come faith, but Isaiah's complaint, if you want to call it that, is it isn't working. I've told them and told them and told them, but they aren't believing me. And Paul's conclusion is that if that's the case, then the issue of faith is that it has to come out of the reporting, the sound, the hearing. But it also has to have this idea that it's our report, which was commissioned in Isaiah 6. Therefore, the sender has to be the one who determines how and who, or by whom, it's going to go forth. So even though the conclusion is a little bit unlikely in the fact that it's drawn from Isaiah 53:1, which basically is an understatement, who has believed our report? Paul said in verse 16, they did not all heed the glad tidings. That's really an understatement, because hardly any did in relative comparison. But nonetheless, the point is that Isaiah's declaration was that Israel wasn't believing. And if the hearing is ineffective in most cases, why claim that the faith arises from the hearing? And the answer to that is because the claim's true. The process is not undercut by the fact that it fails more often than it succeeds. Paul even raised that issue in Romans. He said, does the unbelief of some nullify the faithfulness of God? And the answer is no. It just keeps you from being able to benefit from his faithfulness. But I think it's this train of thought that enables us to understand what he says next. Because what he says next in verse 18 is, and this is New American Standard Translation, but I say, surely they have never heard, have they? Indeed they have. Their voice has gone out into all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. That's a Psalm 19:4 quote, and that's where we're going to be going this evening. We'll eventually get there. But the first thing that I want us to consider is the question, does Paul's conclusion from Isaiah 53:1 mean that it's a lack of hearing that's the reason for the lack of faith? Because he says you have to hear in order to have faith, and yet the hearing hasn't produced the faith. And so one of the questions that Paul is asking in verse 18 is, if the problem is that they haven't heard. Now, he said in verses 13 through 15 that salvation was the outcome of calling on the name of the Lord. Calling on the name of the Lord was the outcome of believing in him. And believing in him was the outcome of hearing from him or of him. And hearing of him was the outcome of a proclaimer. And the proclaimer was the outcome of a sender. And so this is the whole issue is, well, if this chain of events works, then maybe the reason why people weren't believing is because they haven't heard. And that's the issue in verse 18 that he's raising. Because you have to remember the conclusions that he has drawn in verses 16 and 17. And that is that the who has believed our report means that belief requires the prior report. Faith comes out of hearing. And the second conclusion is that our report means that the reporting requires the sending by the Lord. Thus, the hearing arises out of the commissioning of Christ. In Isaiah's case, it was Isaiah 6, where he got the commission, to whom shall I send and who will go for us? Well, here I am, send me. And then in Isaiah 53:1, I went, I told them, and they don't believe me. And with Paul, it was the confrontation on the road to Damascus that convinced him that Jesus was the Christ, and that's the issue of calling on the name of the Lord, is are you willing to confess that Jesus of Nazareth is God's Lord and Christ? Because that's the point. And so Jesus convinced Saul of Tarsus that he was the Lord, because he called him from out of the Shekinah in heaven. And Saul says, well, who are you? And he knew before he even asked that who he was, because there wouldn't be any reason for the question that the voice from heaven wrote, why are you persecuting me? He had to know who he was persecuting, so he had to know who the me was. But anyway, in the confusion of his own mind and the startling confrontation there and the fog that always comes with startle and all that, he said, well, who are you? And he said, I'm Jesus. And that just blew him away. Besides blowing him away, he went blind from probably the brightness of the Shekinah, because it was brighter than the noonday sun. He didn't have his military-grade sunglasses, so he couldn't see. So they led him in the city, and he spent 3 days fasting and praying. And then Ananias was sent to him to lay his hands on him. He received the Holy Spirit. Scales fell off his eyes. And Ananias was to tell him by Jesus' insistence that he was appointed to be an apostle to the Gentiles. So that was Paul's Isaiah 6 confrontation and commissioning. And now he's been out on the road. This letter was written, I don't know, but surely after the second missionary journey. So he's been involved in the process a long time, and he's thought his way through the doctrinal stuff, and Jesus has expressed the truth to him in Arabia. So he's dealt with all these issues, and what he's been arguing is that this message is necessary. I've got to be sent by God to the Gentiles, because they're not going to call on the Lord if they haven't heard of him. And so there's this little area of some confusion in the minds of the readers. Well, Paul, are you saying that they haven't heard? Or are you saying that the hearing they're getting from you is really not all that necessary? And so Paul raises this issue in verse 18. And I think that we need to understand the possible reaction, and then we'll look at his words itself. The possible reaction to his statement that Isaiah 53:1 says both of these things. You have to have the hearing in order to have faith. And in order to have the hearing, you have to have a sender. A sent one also. I mean, a sender and a sent one. But if that's in the scenario, if faith arises out of hearing, and the hearing's kind of necessary on the basis of the chain of events in verse 13 through 15. But the hearing is discriminate in the sense that it rests upon the commissioning of Christ in both his commissioning and particular oversight. Because we saw last time in our study that Paul's desire to go into one area was blocked by the Spirit, who is identified as the Spirit of Christ, but he's also the Holy Spirit. He's also the Spirit of God, but nonetheless, he was blocked from going in that direction and then given a vision of a Macedonian calling for him to come over there. So he took that as the indication that the Spirit was directing him to go to Greece. So if that's the case, then what about those people that Paul was going to go to but was restricted from by Jesus, even if it was the Holy Spirit or the Spirit of Jesus? Nonetheless, he was blocked from going there. So if this faith that comes out of hearing is coming out of a hearing that's discriminate because it rests upon the commissioning of the Christ, and perhaps the lack of faith is caused by the absence of a universal non-discriminating hearing. I mean, if you're going to say that the hearing is necessary for the believing, then maybe the lack of believing is caused by the lack of a hearing. Especially if you have examples in the Scripture of Jesus forbidding the hearing and to certain people at certain times. So that's one of the things that the people that were reading it could have decided, is that the real problem with unbelief is that Jesus has forbidden the hearing. And so one of the things we see in that possible reaction that Paul anticipates, because he's constantly anticipating what his readers are going to think or perhaps conclude, and he wants to address that. This is a typical human response. Paul is fully aware of the typical human responses, because the bottom line here is that the person who would say, well, if they don't believe, it's because they haven't heard, and if they haven't heard, it's because Jesus hadn't given them a hearing. So this is unbelief is really Jesus' fault. And that's the way people do. They blame God for not doing whatever it is that's necessary for men to be compelled to do whatever they're supposed to do. It's God's fault if this doesn't happen because he didn't put it in their hearts or whatever. And Paul knows that's the way people are thinking. And so he anticipates that his doctrine, that the hearing is rooted in the commissioning and the oversight. He's fully aware that some people are going to take that and run with it. Well, then, they didn't hear. Is that what you're saying, Paul? And that's what he's asking. But am I saying they have not heard? Now, these words in verse 18, I believe, and I'm getting gun-shy about saying this, but I believe these are mistranslated, and I'll show you why. The bigger, larger picture is not a big deal, but nonetheless, I think that we can follow his train of thought better if we understand exactly what he did say. Because in verse 18, the first word, that but, is another one of those strong adversative concepts, and that we looked at that in, I think, in verse 16. And in fact, in the book of Romans, this strong adversative but, which I've just called the whiplash adversative, you're going this way and all of a sudden you have to go the other way. It's this but, and there you go. So when Paul uses the but, he is saying, no, that's the wrong conclusion to draw. If he's anticipating a conclusion that says, well, then, you know, they haven't heard. That's the reason they don't believe. And it's amazing to me how many missionary preaching things is rooted in that mistaken notion. People are often presented as hungering to know the truth, and nobody's taken the word to them. That's as much baloney as the baloney we bought at Aldi's. That just won't fly. But nonetheless, it's the one that's used constantly and it's repeated over and over, and people have bought into it and on and on. But this adversative means that we have to understand verse 18 as a contradiction to an idea, and the idea is expressed in verse 18. Surely they've never heard. But his question is, what am I saying? The but is strongly adversative. I say is lego, which means, is this my doctrine? Is this what I'm claiming to be the truth? So when he says, but, am I saying, and it's all a question. There are some who take it as, but I say, and then there's the question. Surely they never heard, have they? But the real issue is, but am I saying, surely they have never heard. because the half day is not in there.
The Greek text says, but am I saying, surely they have never heard.
And then we get to the response. The New American Standard translates it, indeed they have. I think the King James says, yea, barely, or something along that line. Am I wrong, or are you not in the King James? Okay, doesn't matter. But anyway, both the King James and the New American Standard give you the impression that the words ought to be translated in some form of, yes, indeed they have. But the words are a negative. The Logos Bibles program gives you the meaning of the words that are used here, and it is nay, verily. So he's not asking if they've ever heard. Yes, they have. He's asking, is it my doctrine that they have never heard? And the answer is no, indeed. And then he quotes a text that says, yeah, they have heard. So the point that Paul is making is, we have to be sure of the doctrine that he's developing here when he says that faith comes by hearing and hearing by the commissioning and oversight of the Lord, of Christ. Does that mean that people somehow are exempt from the necessity of faith because they haven't ever heard? Is that my doctrine? And he says, no. No, that's not my doctrine. Indeed, no. No, verily, or no, rather. What is my doctrine? Their voice has gone out into all the earth and their words to the ends of the world. What does that mean? The point that I want to make here is that for whatever reasons, the translators have been swayed into casting his words into a question about whether they have heard and a declaration that indeed they have. But the words actually question whether it's Paul's doctrine that they have not heard, and his answer is, no, that's not what I'm saying. Rather, what I'm saying is, they have heard because, and then he gives a quote that comes, it's an exact quote from the Septuagint translation of the Hebrew text of what in our Bibles is Psalm 19, verse 4. And the reason I say it that way is because if you look in the Septuagint, you won't find this in Psalm 19, verse 4 in the Septuagint, because in the Septuagint, it's in Psalm 18, verse 5. But the reason is because the Septuagint as a translation of the Hebrew text has some information in it that we don't have in our Bibles. And as a consequence, the division of the material is not consistent. There are many places in the Septuagint where if you look at the Hebrew, and then you look for it in the Septuagint, you're not going to find our Bible giving you the right chapter and verse, because it'll be a different chapter and verse in the Septuagint. It's not a problem if you can read the Greek or the English, because you can flip front and back just a chapter or two, and you'll find it. That's there. It's just that they divided it up differently. It's not a matter of inspiration. The division issues of chapters and verses and all that were not inspired. So that's not a problem. As far as what we're talking about, he just quotes the Septuagint. He doesn't say it's in Psalm 19:4, but that's where we find it in our English translations. Technically, it's a direct quote of Psalm 18:5 in the Septuagint. But it's a verbatim quote. He doesn't omit, he doesn't alter, he doesn't change, he doesn't add. This is what the psalmist says in the Septuagint translation. By the way, the psalmist in Psalm 19 was David. And he said this, their voice has gone out into all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. So, what we want to see is that Paul's doctrine is not that salvation is rooted in a discriminating Christ who only gives some a hearing, but rather, the lack of salvation is rooted in the consistent rejection of a hearing that every single human being is given. Now, in order to validate that, I'd like for you to look at Psalm 19. You may be very familiar with it. But Psalm 19 is that relatively well-known psalm where David extols the revelation that God has given in two forms. In Psalm 19, 1 through 6, the revelation is identified as what the theologians call natural revelation. He says, the heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There's no speech, there are no words, their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their utterances to the end of the world. Now that's the text that Paul actually quotes verbatim from the Septuagint. It's translated here, their line has gone out, but in Paul's quote, it's their sound has gone out. And their words have gone to the end of the world. And then he tells us what he's talking about. Their line, their utterances, what? Well, it says in verse 4, in them he has placed a tent for the sun. So he's talking about the stellar heavens. He's talking about the speech and the words of the creation that's called the heavens are telling the glory of God, and the expanse is declaring the work of his hands. The expanse is the heaven, and the issues of the telling is in the stars. And the day-to-day pours forth speech and night-to-night reveals knowledge is talking about how God has used the sun and the moon and the stars as a divine revelation of himself. He admits in verse 3 that there's no speech and there are no words. Their voice isn't heard. But then he turns right around and says their sound has gone out through all the earth and their utterances to the end of the world, even though there's no sound and there are no utterances in terms of sound and words. But he says in verse 5, the sun is a bridegroom. It's as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. It rejoices as a strong man to run its course. So, the rising of the sun is from one end of the heavens, and its circuit is to the other end of them, and there's nothing hidden from its heat. So he's talking here about natural revelation. And he's talking about how the creation has identified certain characteristics about God. Even though there are no sounds, and technically there are no words, there is yet a sound, and there is yet a set of words, because what is happening in natural revelation is a revelation to human beings, and they're responsible for what it tells them. And then in verse 7 through 14, he switches to what we call special revelation. The law of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true. They're righteous altogether. They're more desirable than gold. Yes, even much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and the droppings of the honeycomb. Moreover, by them thy servant is warned. In keeping them there's great reward. And who can discern his errors? Acquit me of hidden faults. Keep back your servant from presumptuous sins, and let them not rule over me. Then I will be blameless, and I will be acquitted of great transgressions. And then that famous, let the words of my mouth and meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Now it's clear from the psalm that David recognizes that there are two levels of divine revelation. Both of them have an ability to impact men. But the Word of God, the actual revelation of the prophets and so forth, is a more advanced revelation that has greater potential for impact because it is actually verbal revelation. Because he talks about the law, the testimony, the precepts, the commandments, the fear of the Lord, the judgments of the Lord, and so on. He talks about these as if they're a great advantage. But in quoting, when Paul quotes from the natural revelation section in verse 4, their sound has gone throughout all the earth and their utterances to the end of the world, we need to understand what he's doing there. Because the whole point is that, well, actually, the whole point is Romans 1, verses 19 and 20. Before we go there, though, I want to point out something about the statements in verse 4 of Psalm 19. The word translated line is actually a word for sound. And this, in Paul's thinking, is a direct issue of hearing.
if you have to hear in order to call, then if hearing is necessary for faith so that you can call, then this issue of hearing is a critical issue. And he says the hearing, the sound, has gone out. And the whole the word there is it's gone through all the earth, which is the word for the globe as a creation of dirt and water and all that. So that this covers the whole globe. But then he reinforces it in verse 4 at the second statement. Their utterances, that's the word phremata. That's the word phrema that's used in Romans 10, where if you hear the phrema of the gospel, the word of the gospel, the word of faith which we preach, then you can call on the name of the Lord and be saved. If you hear that. Well, here this utterances is actually technically words. Their words go to, and now he switches. He says it goes to the end of the inhabited world. So in two ways in verse 4 of Psalm 19, he has said that the sound and the words have reached all of the nooks and crannies of all of God's earthly creation. There is no place where their sound is not heard. Everybody in any place on the earth has received this revelation from God. Now, and we need to understand what's really going on in Romans, in Paul's theology. So I want us to go back to Romans chapter 1 and look at an earlier statement of this same theology and see if we can understand what Paul is actually driving at in Romans 10. Because as we've already seen in Romans 10, the hearing doesn't guarantee a positive response on the part of the person who hears it. Isaiah says, has almost no impact. They don't believe me. And Paul says, even though they don't all believe, the fact is, faith comes from hearing. So he's arguing within the context of resistance to the things heard. But he's already said that in Romans chapter 1. Because in Romans chapter 1, he says in verse 19, that which is known about God is manifest or evident within them because God made it evident to them. And his statement, God has made it evident to them, is rooted in verse 20. Because, or for, since the creation of the world, the invisible things, or God's invisible attributes, and then he identifies the two that he's talking about, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. Now what he's saying here is difficult for a lot of people to accept, because what he's saying is, from the beginning of creation, there have been two things that were so manifest from creation that nobody is going to be able to stand before God with an excuse. Those two things are his power and then what is called here his divine nature. But that word is translated, King James calls it his Godhead. The issue there boils down to the reality of his identity as a person. So that power and personhood are clearly seen. And it's based on those invisible things that can be made seen by the things that he made. And there are two things that have to be true from the existence of creation. One of them is power. Who can argue that there is no need for great massive power to explain the existence of creation? Nobody can argue against that with any sense. I mean, sure, atheists claim that there's no solid line of reasoning there, but it's not reasoning, it's their perverse resistance that's causing them to say that. But the truth of the matter is, even the Big Bang Theory has this enormous explosive power that has resulted in the creation. So the logic from the size and existence of the creation to power is that's a non-starter to deny that. That's a no-brainer. You have got to be able to admit that what exists in creation has to have been created or come into existence by some type of humongous amount of power as far as we measure power, as far as human beings do. You know, that was one of the problems with the atomic bomb and theorizing about whether we should even make an atomic bomb back in the 40s, is because the scientists didn't know absolutely positively for sure that if they started this initial splitting of these atoms and it created this enormous to make a bomb, they weren't positively sure that that wouldn't just create an automatic continuation of the result reaction until there wasn't any world left. I mean, if you start splitting them and the power that's there keeps splitting them, well, then how are you going to keep them from continuing to split and split and split until there's nothing left? That was a concern. But I guess in some ways they decided that... Well, somehow or another, they convinced themselves that there probably wouldn't be that continuous thing. But anyhow, I remember reading about that as one of the issues of debate in the creation of an atomic bomb. Well, what they were dealing with there was trying to release the power that was inherent in the thing created. And even if they wouldn't admit that it was created, they couldn't deny the power. So God says, look, if you want to say there was no powerful being that created this stuff, that's on you. Because there is nothing in your experience that will support that argument. Nothing. Cause and effect is a fundamental principle of all of human activity. And even though they've managed to use their sophistry to work it out some way in philosophical stuff to where it's not, it is. I mean, there's nothing you can do if you dismiss the law of cause and effect. You can't even walk across the floor. Because putting your foot down is a cause thing. The grip and the traction that's there because of the law of gravity and a few other things is a part of what you understand to be the basis for the next cause, which will be the next step. So there's nothing. There's nothing that you can do that you can't, somebody can't say, okay, now, what was the process here and how does that work? And the way it works is the law of cause and effect is in play. It's always in play and you can't get out of it. And that's why one of the arguments in the philosophical debates was the law of cause and effect. The first and second laws of the thermodynamics argue, you throw that out, you got nothing. You're just a brainless nothing. So Paul says, power is one of the deals. I think that the translation Godhead or divine nature masks the issue, because the next thing that's automatically necessary is the reality of personhood. You can't get persons from non-persons. The existence of a thing assumes a greater degree of whatever it is that you've generated here. There has to be something above that's capable of that. And you can't get mind out of mindlessness. You can't get personhood out of impersonal force. So the personhood, the personal nature of the powerful God, Paul says, has been made clear by the things made so that nobody is going to be able to stand before God and effectively argue, well, I didn't see it that way. And what's the reason? Verse 21. They knew God, but they didn't want to. They didn't want to honor Him as God. They didn't want to be thankful. They became futile in their speculations and their foolish hearts were darkened. And professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And the greatness of their foolishness, verse 23, which Isaiah picks up on and mocks them consistently in Isaiah. You guys, you bow before that tree that you just carved into an image of an idol out of a tree that you cut up part of it for the fire. You're the one that created this. That thing can't talk. It can't act. It can't answer your prayers, and yet you bow down and worship it as if it could do all those things. And it can't do any of them. He said, you guys are idiots. Well, Paul would agree. But it wasn't on the basis of not knowing. It was on the basis of being unwilling to acknowledge their knowledge. They didn't want to know God. They knew Him as God, but they didn't like it. So what's Paul's point in Romans 10? His point in Romans 10 is, Isaiah admits that people don't want to hear it. Isaiah said, they've been hearing it. I've been telling them, but they don't believe me. Lord, who has believed me? And then Paul comes along and says, well then, in verse 18, the argument, am I saying that they haven't heard? Is that the reason they don't believe? And the answer is absolutely not. I am not saying that. Psalm 19 says that's not the solution to the problem of their unbelief. Psalm 19 argues, yeah, they have heard. And he goes on in verses 19 through 21, which we're not going to try to cover this evening, but I just want to point out, when he shifts from the universal, there's nobody who has not felt the heat of the sun, he says, Psalm 19. He then switches specifically to Israel, which is a shift to Psalm 19, verses 7 through 14. Israel. Surely Israel didn't know, did they? Yeah, Moses said from the beginning. And then he goes down in verse 21 and says, as for Israel, all the day long I've stretched out my hands to a disobedient and obstinate people. So if you are looking for a reason for unbelief, it's not in the fact that they didn't hear. That's why he argues in verse 18 that they have never heard, have they? Indeed, they have. Or am I saying that they've never heard? No! They have heard. That's not the answer to the question of the disbelief in the hearing. If you want to be saved, you have to respond to what you have heard. And that brings us back to the issue in Romans 1 and in 19, and that is the issue of just how potent is this argument that they've known this. Creation has declared this from the beginning. God has made it evident to them. They didn't want to hear it, but they know they're there. It's there. But what is the actual argument there? Well, I think that Paul is arguing that eternal power in Romans 1 pushes for recognition of the basic issue. And he is pushing the Godhead concept or the personality of God to pursue the same result. That is, a recognition of this basic issue. The basic issue is, in Romans 10, good news of good things. That's the basic issue of the gospel. How beautiful are the feet of those who come bringing good news of good things. Well, this beautiful feet thing, apparently, is not beautiful feet to most of them because the most of them don't embrace the message. They hear this message, but they're not interested in it because of some other implications. I mean, anybody in his right mind would want the good things that are involved in the good news. If there weren't complications, but there are. And the biggest complication is the resistance that's built into the heart of unbelieving man. But what is his argument, really? Well, I think it's ironic that men have consistently used what I call the empty problem of evil. One of the biggest philosophical things is the problem of evil. Well, to me, that's a non-starter. The problem is not the problem of evil, because the problem of evil is usually cast in these terms. How can evil exist in the creation of a good God? That's the so-called problem of evil. But I think that's an empty problem. I think the greater problem is, how do you explain the presence of good in an evil creation? Rather than trying to explain the problem of evil existing in a good creation or a creation of a good God, how would you explain if you turned that on its head and said, well, what if we approach the issue of good things in this world that are our experience? How do you explain those if the creation is essentially evil? Paul would say, explaining evil in the presence of a good God, good creation, is not nearly the problem
that the problem is if you try to explain the presence of good in an evil creation for this reason or for these reasons. Number one, it is the nature of evil to destroy good. That's the nature of evil. It's to destroy good. But it is not the nature of good to destroy all evil. I'll make this argument this way. Good, by definition, involves a toleration of some levels of evil, and it is a testament to its goodness that it tolerates it. And I'm going to say that this way. Who, in their right mind, would deny that grace, mercy, patience, long-suffering, and any of those other characteristics that involve having to deal with evil and the negative issues involved in the presence of evil. Who would deny that those are not good, or that those are good things? Who would deny that? Who would deny that mercy is a good thing? Who would argue that grace is an evil? Who would argue that patience and kindness and gentleness are evil? Everybody argues that what the world needs now is love, sweet love. If we just love everybody. Well, why do you want to love everybody unless love's a good thing? And if love's a good thing, how do you explain its presence in a creation that's essentially evil? Essential evil destroys all good. But the biblical statement about the nature of good is that God, who is good, is never going to completely eliminate all evil from his good creation. The statement of the book of Revelation that the smoke of their torment will ascend forever. That's the smoke of the torment of the wicked who've been cast in the lake of fire. The smoke of their torment will ascend forever means that forever evil is still going to be an essential element in the creation of the good God. Why? Well, it's interesting that the scriptures never argue that good can be forced to serve evil ends, but it does argue very strongly that evil can be forced to serve good ends. Romans 8:28 point blankly says that God is going to force even evil things, evil experiences, evil actions to our good. He's going to force it to work to our good. Well, that means that evil can be forced by good to serve its ends. But alternatively, it's not true that good things can be forced by evil to serve evil ends. Can't argue that. There's no basis for that argument. So, the bottom line in Isaiah 53, in Romans chapter 10, Romans chapter 1, Psalm 19, the bottom line is that no matter what the hearing is, it is met more times than not with disbelief by the large majority. In fact, we could say it never is met by faith by the large majority. Always met by resistance resulting in disbelief. So the problem of not believing is not caused by not knowing, not hearing. It's caused by this internal resistance thing. So the problem of no faith, even though there is a connection between you have to hear in order to believe, the problem of the lack of faith is not the lack of hearing. It's not a discriminatory restriction upon what is heard by the Christ. There was no discrimination at creation. When he created the good creation and the creation testifies of the invisible attributes that cannot be ejected, they're without excuse, it's been made plain, God has made it obvious to them. That has happened. There was no discrimination that. The psalmist says there is no place that does not feel the heat of the sun as a good thing. The sun is only, basically, it only has two major functions. One of them is light and the other is heat. Both of those are really good things unless you get into the extremes. There is such a thing, Paul says to Timothy,
of light unapproachable. It's full of glory. That means you'll die if you get too close. So there is an extreme example of light that's dangerous for creatures. But by the same token, heat in its extreme is what the lake of fire is. That's dangerous for creatures too. But in typical terms, light and heat are very beneficial things. And Paul says, even if you can't see the light, you can feel the heat. So there is no creature that is excusable. The good exists. And you have to answer the question, if good exists, where did it come from? And Paul's argument is, cause and effect says it comes from a good God. There isn't any other explanation. So the problem isn't a discriminatory restriction until after the fact. There is no question that God's choice of Abraham and through him, Isaac and Jacob and the nation of Israel, there's no question that there is discrimination there. There is. Moses said, God has chosen you out of all of the nations of the world. You're a special people. That's discrimination on God's part. But it isn't ungodly discrimination. It's a discrimination in terms of how he's going to pull people out of the darkness and the evil and the consequences of that. It's a discrimination based on a plan to bring good out of the evil that has invaded. And that's just my argument. You can force evil to serve good ends, but you can't force good to serve evil ends. So the problem is not a discriminatory restriction from the sender. The sender may say, well, don't tell them, but do tell them. And even Jesus did that in the earthly ministry. He said, don't go to the Gentiles, just go to the house of Israel. That's all. Don't go any further. So in that sense, he restricted everybody except those that lived in that 150 mile by 50 mile piece of geography. But then he expanded the reach. He said, you know, go tell them all of them. The problem is that no matter what God reveals, it is consistently met with contempt and antagonistic disbelief because of the nature of man that has been imposed on him by the fall. So if people are going to automatically respond with contempt and antagonism, Jesus is perfectly right to say, well, don't go tell them. Go tell them. Now, will the telling of them be more favorable than the non-telling of them? Well, for those that believe it. But if you don't believe it and you have been told with more clarity, then guess what? The greater your exposure, the greater your responsibility. So it's really not a good thing to have the law of the Lord if you've already rejected the heavens declaring the glory of God and the firmament showing his handiwork. I mean, if you're going to reject at that level and then God comes along and gives you the law, look at what's happened to Israel under the discerning judgment of God based on their rejection of very clear instructions. What they've had to endure has been horrible over the last 2,000 years. It's just an example of the greater knowledge you possess, the greater your responsibility to respond properly. So I think that's what's going on in verse 18 that Paul is saying. Is it my theology that they haven't heard? No, not at all. They have heard. And we'll look into the rest of it in the weeks to come, Lord willing.